Welcome to season 4 of the Brave Writer podcast, A Brave Writer's Life in Brief. I'm Julie Bogart, your host. This season, we are releasing via audio our most popular YouTube broadcasts. We're so excited that you can now listen to these on audio while you're running, driving in the car, or folding laundry. We will also sprinkle throughout this season original content, interviews with people I think are compelling to listen to. If you get a chance, please help us out by leaving a review at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to Brave Writers podcast. We really appreciate it. It helps us get the word out, and it also gratifies all the people behind the scenes who work so hard to bring these to you for free. And now, let's get going with this episode. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Barbara Oakley, PhD, educator, writer, engineer, and perhaps most importantly, a female Indiana Jones, an accolade confirmed via Barbara's Twitter bio. In any case, Barbara's work has really fascinated me over the last year. She focuses on the complex relationship between neuroscience and social behavior. She's contributed to the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and countless other distinguished publications and journals. Along the journey, Barbara has also penned and published 9 books. I could actually spend this whole podcast just listing her prestigious educational degrees, certifications, awards, and honors, but let's just suffice it to say they are not only extensive, they are well-deserved. If you're a Brave Writer fan, and I imagine you are, or you wouldn't be here listening, then you're going to love Barbara's newest book, called Learning How to Learn. And it was published today as we're recording this podcast. So I'm thrilled that Barbara's here celebrating Publication Day with us. Years ago, when I launched the Homeschool Alliance, our coaching community, one of the members introduced me to Barbara's online Coursera course called Learning How to Learn. And I eagerly took the entire course and was profoundly influenced by her ideas. Today's book, Learning How to Learn, is aimed at your kids, your teens, your junior high students who are wanting to maximize their capacity to retain what they learn. So without further ado, let's interrogate Barbara and find out how she can help us with our homeschools. Hi, Barbara. Welcome.
Oh, Julie, it's such a pleasure to be here. And I'm very excited with book launch day today. But it is just such a pleasure to meet again online here. We had the pleasure of having dinner recently together. And so this is an even more fun experience, I think.
Absolutely. In fact, for those who don't know, Barbara and I have the same book agent, the same editor, the same publisher. So we have all these overlapping commitments and relationships, which fostered just this instantaneous connection. So I loved that dinner, by the way.
It was one of the nicest dinners I've had in such a long time. And so it's just so great to meet a kindred spirit in writing.
Absolutely. I'm with you 100%. And for those who don't know, Barb has a fabulous book called A Mind for Numbers, which helps dispel myths around how to learn math. And she is a recovered math phobic who is now an engineer. And so this is where I want to start, Barbara. I know that you know a lot about learning because you overcame one of the chief phobias many students suffer from, and that is mathematics. So can you share a little of that story?
Well, to summarize, I was terrible in math growing up, and I think it was sparked when I was just a little kid. We moved, and I was 7 years old, and they were way far ahead of me in the multiplication tables, and then I didn't like math anyway, and so I just sort of flunked my way through elementary and middle and high school math and science. I thought the only thing I could do was maybe learn another language. So I found out about a program. They pay you to learn another language.
Wow.
And it was known as the Army. And so I joined, I enlisted, and I learned Russian. and went to the Defense Language Institute, which is one of the world's premier language learning organizations or institutions. And I didn't realize it at the time, but the fundamentals of how you learn a language are very similar to the fundamentals that you learn in anything, even in math and science. So when I got out of the Army when I was 26 and I was casting about for what can I do? I mean, nobody wanted my Russian language skills. There's very few jobs. And I thought, why don't I try and retrain my brain and see if I can learn math and science? And when I used those same techniques I had used to learn a language that I'd been taught by the Defense Language Institute, oh, lo and behold, they worked. And so wow. part of what I want to do today is share what is the underlying approach, the commonality that can make you successful, whether you're learning a language, learning in math and science, learning dance, how to play the guitar,
wow,
whatever. And it's actually, if I'd known then what I'd know now, I could have so made it easier on myself.
That's amazing. So do you have a core principle that guides this understanding of learning? Is there a way to express it briefly, or is it a series of practices? How do you understand the theory of learning?
Oh, very good question. I think good learning is kind of like baking a good cake. It's got lots of different ingredients in it. And you can't summarize it as, you know, it's the icing or the eggs or the, you know, it depends on what's the temperature, what's the pressure, what kind of flour are you using and so forth. So learning is a lot like that. I can say that there are several areas that are really being shown to be of vital importance in learning. The first one is laying neural sets of links. You want to have a set of links that your working memory, your short-term memory, can just call to mind instantly. And a good example of this is backing up a car. So when you're first learning to back up a car, it seems almost impossible. I mean, do you look in the side mirror, the front mirror? Do you look behind you? And besides all that, the car is moving while you're trying to figure all this stuff out. But once you have created a set of links about how to back up a car, all you have to do is say, think, oh, I want to back up a car. And you can do it without too much difficulty at all. You just call that set of links up into working memory and boom, you're on your way. You can even listen to the radio or check your seatbelts while you're at it. You can do some other things because you've created that solid set of neural links. So creating a set of neural links is one key principle, and all experts have a big library of these sets of neural links that they use. Other key ideas related to learning are that you have focused and diffuse modes. So in other words, when you think that you can't understand something and you're really frustrated, bashing your head against the book, trying to figure out what in the heck is going on, that's often because you've been using the focused mode, but there's another network in your brain of much more diffuse, broad range connections. So you have to kind of let go with whatever you're thinking or you're focusing on and just relax or work on something else or go for a walk or go to sleep. That allows this other set of networks, this other mode, the diffuse mode, to begin grappling with and making sense of the material. And that's why when you come back later to focus again on the material, it begins to make sense. So that's two of the three. The third one is dealing effectively with procrastination. So I think there's tools and techniques for that. But if you kind of have a handle on those three different things, you're kind of on your way with learning.
I really love that you gave us this overarching structure of three basic principles. Within those principles, then, your book details some practices, correct? Things that help those brain links get established or that help them move from diffuse to focused mode.
Exactly right. So it's actually pretty easy to move into focus mode. It's like a flashlight you turn on. You just focus your attention on something and boom, it's there. But getting into diffuse mode can sometimes be more difficult. It's like falling asleep a little bit. In fact, falling asleep is part of diffuse mode, but you can't command your brain not to focus on things. It kind of relaxes into it. And so I think that's quite interesting. And you can't be in both modes at the same time unless you're taking certain forms of mushrooms. And I'm certainly not advocating that.
No, heavens no. So what is an example, perhaps a story of a student you know who has applied a principle or a technique that you could share with us, maybe an example from your experience of working with people?
Well, let's see. Oh, there's so many.
I can imagine. I should have prepared you. I'm sorry.
No. That's my... So I will first just say that, okay, I have a nephew. And this nephew was studying software engineering, and he was flunking out of the program. So his dad gave him a copy of A Mind for Numbers, and he said, okay, I'll try it. And the next semester, he was on the dean's list. So it is very possible to I think you want to not start with everything, but little things matter when you're learning. So trying to start, first off, just getting past procrastination is, I think, one of the most powerful ways people use some of these ideas to help them improve their learning. I've heard from so many people over the years who were flunking their engineering program or flunking a science program, and they read some of these ideas, or they took the course Learning How to Learn, and they flourished. They went from flunking to actually being very successful. It really makes you feel good. I'm actually standing on the shoulders of great giants, brilliant researchers in neuroscience and psychology who've done a lot of great research, but a lot of this just isn't out, I think, in the real world.
Well, in fact, as I listen to you, so I'm going to jump in here with some real world for you. I can picture someone in a graduate course or even college reading about how to stop procrastinating and making the application and improving once they have the information they need. What do we do with 11-year-olds? You know, we've got them under our roofs. Maybe they're resistant and they're saying things like, well, I'm just bad at math. I'm stupid. And then their procrastination often is a defense mechanism. It's a fear of failure, of disappointing a parent, of having experienced limited success in the past, right? So how do we help an 11-year-old actually gain the will to test a technique or to be curious again after they've experienced a failure?
That's a great question. And I'll begin by talking about my own daughters. Let's just say they weren't thrilled about the idea of learning math. Our older daughter, she just wasn't that good at math. And she would have been one of those little girls who grew up and said, you know, I just don't have the math gene, never really did very well. Our younger daughter could do math, but she just did not want to. And so it was always kicking and screaming. But I figured I didn't want to be a tiger mom because it's just not my personality. I'm more laid back. But I thought I get to pick one thing that I will make them do even if they don't want to do it. And that one thing was I had them do an extra 20 minutes of math a day with a program called Kumon Mathematics. There's online program, a good online program nowadays is called Smartick, S-M-A-R-T-I-C-K. And both of these programs What they do is they help kids practice and get a little bit of that neural structure that they need, because it's pretty clear that the U.S. system of education often does not provide for enough practice to really allow these neural patterns to develop and be solidly in place.
Wow. I just want to pause that for a moment, because that's a fascinating fact to me. One of the things that I've often advocated for parents is to lower the bar to experience success. So a lot of times we ask our kids to do so much work, they lose focus, they become bored, they don't give the kind of dedicated concentration needed to be successful. So if they shorten the number or reduce the number of problems, they can give full concentration and then take a break and maybe resume. You're suggesting maybe lengthening the time or the amount of practice. Is it possible to do that in a way where kids don't become either sloppy or lackadaisical or, you know, swing their feet under the table? And do you agree with what my suggestion is, or do you challenge it? Do you have another way of understanding how to help these kids bridge into a more disciplined, longer approach to math?
Well, I think the trick is not doing anything for too long a period of time.
Okay.
That's the real trick. So you don't want to say to a child, I expect you to sit down and practice this for an hour or for 2 hours.
Right.
Unless the kid really wants to do that. And if they do, you know, that's great, and let them go for it. But it's a very good idea to allow them to do, like, the use of the Pomodoro is a great anti-procrastination technique, and it also deals with what we're speaking about here.
Okay.
So very quickly, the Pomodoro technique involves turning off all distractions. So you turn off cell phone, no pop-up on the computer or whatever. Set your timer for 25 minutes. Focus as intently as you can, realizing that we all have monkey minds and you'll have to bring attention back for 25 minutes. And then when you're done, giving yourself a reward. And that reward is really, really important, because it helps to program the mind into thinking, oh, this focusing is fun because I get a reward out of it. And I think all too often we with kids, will be do all this, but it turns into this interminable length of stuff you have to do, and it's actually kind of depressing. Whereas if you break it up into, hey, if you do 25 minutes, you can do whatever you want for 5, 10, 15 minutes, set a timer. And if you play that kind of game with kids, even very reluctant kids, if you have to give them some reward, let's say you get to play with your video games for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, well, they actually can often be brought to cooperate. But we often think that learning should always be great fun for students, and that if it's not great fun, that we're doing something wrong. But that's actually not correct. If we teach about learning in that way, we're actually making it so much more difficult for them to be successful when they get to college, for example, and they're faced with really difficult topics. You know, they are charging into calculus, or they're going into microbiology or something that's... If we've always been, well, learning's really fun, then they'll just quit because, hey, that's no fun.
That's true. In fact, one of the language pieces I use when I talk about that is stamina. We're wanting kids to have the will and the stamina to master what is challenging. It's not just about success, success, success. Sometimes there's a period of struggle. And how do we empower our kids to face the challenge and to not wilt in front of it? You know, when we're asking a child to learn to read, we can certainly dazzle them with the power of reading and get them enticed to read. But there is a hard work piece. Sounding out is tedious. It's challenging. It's sometimes fraught with error. And helping our kids develop the resilience to keep risking and attempting when it has not come easily to them is the sticking point in most homeschools. You're listening to the Brave Writer Podcast, and I'm Julie Bogart. If you're one of those people who wishes there were more podcasts than I can get done week to week, well, you're in luck. The Homeschool Alliance is my homeschool coaching community. There are over 400 members and three coaches. There's me, Stephanie Elms, and Jeannie Faulkner. All three of us together have over 75 years worth of home education and coaching experience. When you join that community, there are audio lectures very similar to podcasts, monthly telecommunications, webinars. We meet in this Zoom chat room so you can talk and I can talk at the same time. We provide you with readings every single month to challenge and stimulate your educational strategies. And we provide you with what I call one thing challenges. We pick some extracurricular activity like movie viewing or art appreciation or water play, and we give you challenges that help you implement that in your homeschool. There's even a self-care spa where we remind you to be good to yourself, and a space for community conversations where you can ask your most vexing homeschool questions to the community. If that sounds like something that you'd enjoy, go to bravewriter.com and scroll down to the band that says the Homeschool Alliance. You can join on a monthly basis or an annual basis. Start and stop anytime, no questions asked. I'd love to meet you and help you have that in-service grad school for homeschool experience you're craving. And now, let's return to the podcast. I love that you talk about this concept of these micro rewards. The language I use is celebration, mostly because sometimes reward is sort of like, I'll give you a Coke if you clean the toilet. It's like bribing someone into doing something they don't want to do. I sort of love to think about this notion of what you just said, 25 minutes, 10 minutes for a young child, and then giving them a meaningful break, something that they value, whether that's jumping on the trampoline, getting a snack, walking around, you're right, playing a video game, playing a game of cards with a sister. You know, we're home all day and we have lots of ways as homeschoolers to create some kind of pride of accomplishment. One suggestion I made recently to a mother who called me was she wondered how to extend the length of copy work that her daughter could do. And I said, well, what if you treat it like a video game? She unlocks new colors of pens each time she goes up another number of sentences. So if she starts with one, she's using her traditional pencil. But when she gets to two sentences, now she can pull out, you know, the blue marker. And it's sort of like unlocking new tools on a video game. You're giving your child an incentive as opposed to, you know, just capitulating to their complaints and need for a break.
That's so true. And I should say on the side that we often tend to think that video games are all bad, but they're actually, and they can be just like anything, just like food, just like exercise. I mean, it can become addictive, and addiction is not a good thing. But some limited use of video games has been, depending on the type, has been shown to be beneficial. For example, it can help build attentional abilities. Tetris can help build spatial abilities. So it's not all bad. There are some good things. And I think it helps parents to realize, you know, that it's okay. A little bit is not going to hurt. It's going to be okay.
I love that you brought up video games because literally it comes up every single month in the Homeschool Alliance. There is almost always a discussion. It is such an uncomfortable part of parenting. And one of the things that helped me in understanding video games was talking with my sons who are gamers. And I discovered, and I think this may be what you're saying, to play a game, whether it's chess or a video game, you have to keep outthinking your opponent. So somebody offers their best thought, the computer or the opponent offers their thought that outthinks you. Now you've got to think again. So there's a certain strategy piece, isn't there, of refining your best thoughts. Is that what you would say about gaming?
Absolutely. And in fact, there are some video games, action style video games, that are in the process of FDA approval for helping improve cognition in older individuals.
Wow.
So if you're an older person and you feel like you're just not as focused and so forth as you were when you were younger, try some action style video games.
I wonder if you could speak for a moment to this notion of flexible thinking. So much of education tends to seem focused on outcomes, you know, passing a test, knowing the right answers, getting the accurate point of view. How is a child sort of led towards this flexibility of thinking in new ways? You know, I know for me, math was a very difficult subject. So when I was teaching my kids, I only knew one way to ever solve any problems, right? I'm not as oriented to mathematics. And over time, I discovered that you could approach a problem in a lot of ways, which was a revelation to me. How do we foster that in our children so that they don't get stuck in this rut of thinking there's one way to do each thing?
Well, the best we can do really is to try to expose kids to the variety of ways of thinking. One big problem is with really, really, really smart kids.
Oh.
Here's the challenge. Really smart kids can figure things out really quickly. And what can happen, though, is they get very used to being really fast and being right. So then as they mature, they can have a tendency, and this was noted by Nobel Prize winner Santiago Ramón y Cajal, who is considered the father of modern neuroscience. But he said, I've worked with many geniuses, and they can have a tendency to jump to conclusions, and then they can't change their mind when they're wrong because they're just not used to it. So the more
interesting
you might, if your child is a really smart child, the more you can encourage and foster the idea that there can be multiple perspectives, and don't get so certain that your answer is right that you become inflexible about it. How that can really, I think you need to be a really smart parent yourself to be able to figure out all sorts of examples where you can point that out. But so often I will meet really, really smart people who will hear what is being said, instantly jump to conclusions, sometimes just going way out on left field. And it's just not helpful for that person, for either person involved.
That's a wonderful way to put it. And I think it is interesting that sometimes the smartest person in the room might be the least flexible thinker. Had really considered that.
Yes. And I think that's why sometimes companies can go awry. Their leaders are really smart. They're able to do a lot of things. But then when something comes up that conflicts with their notions about what's going on, they often just can't hear it. And I've seen that myself in business. One thing I'd like to turn back to is you had mentioned we were discussing verbal abilities.
Yes.
And one thing that I think, actually I have an op-ed coming out today in the New York Times about this, is it's often not realized that when little boys and little girls are developing and they're very young, that there's math skills are pretty much on average the same, but their verbal abilities can be on average quite different.
Wow.
And in fact, little girls often are advanced verbally, and little boys, at least when they're young, can be a little delayed from little girls. They can catch up later. But what this means is that early on, a little boy will look within himself and say, you know, I'm better at analytical. I'm better at math sorts of things. And within himself, that's right. On average, he's better at math. A little girl would look within herself and say, you know, I'm better at verbal sorts of things. This is even though little boys and little girls have virtually the same mathematics abilities.
Wow.
So what this means is a little girl it's like this advantage that actually gives a disadvantage, because a little girl is always kind of going, yeah, but this verbal, it just comes so naturally and more easily. And if you're telling me to follow my passion, well, passions are the areas I'm good at. So I'll follow my verbal abilities. So this is part of why I say it's really important, especially for girls, to get some additional math practice. I mean, with our own daughters, our older daughter, the one who's really bad at math, she's doing her residency now, a medical residency at Stanford. Turned out really just that little bit of extra practice. And our younger daughter is the artistic type. She's a photojournalist, but she got an A in calculus and never lets her older sister forget it. So just that little bit of extra practice, I think, is especially important for little girls to help bring those two up to par. So they're not just always going, oh, I'm better verbally, and then they're not practicing the math, especially because they feel like their verbal abilities are better. And then they end up kind of going off more verbally and not getting some of those analytical skills that they can actually do just fine and that will be really helpful for them in the long term.
This is such a wonderful point. I didn't know that about the research about why girls start disqualifying themselves from math. That speaks very well to me and my own experience. My youngest daughter was attended public high school. She'd been homeschooled through eighth grade, and her math skills were not all the way up to par at that point for algebra, but we enrolled her anyway. And her first test she did poorly on, partly because it was a Scantron, and I didn't remember that I needed to teach her how to use them. So she, you know, misaligned her answers, and there were just a few problems like that. But we also discovered that her math skills just were not up to par. So the teacher said to her, instead of doing just the odds or the evens, I'd like you to do all the problems. Anytime I assign a group 1 through 30, you do 30, don't just do 15. And if you have the energy and time, do the practice tests at the end of each chapter. Well, having been homeschooled, she was used to self-directed learning. She was used to motivation, wanting to know, not doing it because of obligation. She wanted to do well in her class. So for a semester, she followed that protocol and met with the teacher once a week if she had questions. And by the end of the semester, she had an A in her math class and has never looked back. Yep. He said it's the only time he's ever seen a student make that much progress in a semester. And she went on to get a linguistics degree in college, which is kind of the mathematics of language.
Yes,
and
it is.
I found it just incredible to watch her bring these two proficiencies together. She's always been highly verbal, very skilled at writing, and to see those sort of become married through this accidental suggestion, really, just do extra. It just validates everything you're saying, right?
That's exactly right. Well, that's what we're doing. It's that little bit of extra practice that really makes a difference and is especially valuable to help girls realize, oh, wait a minute, I can do this after all. And it makes a huge difference. Their capabilities are just the same. It's just that without that extra practice in math, those shining verbal abilities can kind of outshine their math. And that bit of extra practice can help them to realize, oh, no, wait, I am capable and good at both of these.
I love that. And in fact, this leads me to maybe my last main question about learning how to learn. And it came kind of accidentally and naturally. I wanted to ask you about the role of television, laying on the couch, headphones, keeping a window open with your instant message while you're working. This daughter of mine who did all this math always laid on the couch while she worked on it, and she had like Seinfeld reruns happening in the background, or Friends, things she's already watched, but they would just be on in the background. And I remember thinking, Can she really be learning right now if this is going on? She was giving obviously focused attention and she did wind up with very good grades. But what is the principle? Should we let our kids wear headphones? I felt sort of guilty sometimes as a mom.
Oh, this is a good question. Because 95% of the time, you don't want to have these distractions. So you don't want to have the television going on and other kinds of things happening. But 5% of the time, there are kids who have, especially kids who have really good working memories, they're very capable of holding lots of different things in their mind. And for example, these rare individuals, they can listen to a conversation and be reading something intently, and they can actually grasp both things.
Wow.
So it's rare, but if your child is like that, that's a really great, great skill. So every once in a while, and research has shown that every once in a while, there are kids who are capable of multitasking. And I think it's because they have such an excellent working memory. But you should be very proud of your daughter. But most people, it's a much, much better idea not to multitask.
That really helps because I have to have silence to write, to think, to do my work. And I found her to be surprising that way. But what, like I said, she became a linguistics major and she studied multiple languages at the same time. And I knew I could never do that. So perhaps she does fall into that interesting category. I think that's helpful for parents, though, because there is constantly that discussion with teens, right? They're going to say, well, I think I can do this. One of the things that I have noticed is teens do seem able to have some kind of musical accompaniment in a way that older adults often don't seem as able. Do you notice that? Or would you say even that is too much of a distraction for most people?
Oh, actually, there's been a fair bit of research on the effect of music on your ability to study. And the results are basically whatever you want that research to show. Oh. You can find research that will find that if we show that. But it seems it's kind of dependent on the child, the type of music. If it's a music they don't like, it's not very helpful. But music with lyrics in it can be not so good. But on the other hand, if you've heard the lyrics a whole bunch of times, then it's sort of tuned out.
Got it.
So it sort of depends on the child. It's not necessarily as bad as we think it might be, you know. So I think just having the child kind of play around with
just
it, if they're successful in their studies, they're probably fine.
That's great. Wow. Well, this has been incredibly helpful. I love getting to talk with you. We could do it for hours. And in fact, for those listening, Barb is going to join us in the Homeschool Alliance later this month in August to do an even more in-depth discussion of how to bring this learning experience alive in your families. Barb, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you were dying to share today?
Oh, actually, you are such a great interviewer. I think you've hit, we've covered so many topics that
yes.
it's kind of astonishing. So I just like to say that everything that I am doing now as an engineer has grown from studying language. And so what you're doing with helping with writing is absolutely phenomenally important, and everything I've done relates to, it grows out of my own book writing. And so the more you are doing the great work you're doing with helping kids learn to write well, I think it's just, that is the foundation of excellent learning.
That is such a wonderful way to end. And I thank you for that endorsement, really. It's exciting to be a part of your publishing day. I hope everyone will race to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Indie Books or wherever they shop and pick up a copy of Learning How to Learn. This book is written to kids, right, Barb? It's not written to the parent.
Well, it's written to the kids, but parents, teachers, and anyone who cares about learning or kids learning will really enjoy this book and get a lot out of it.
Yeah, and it comes with illustrations and monsters. It's wonderful. It's not just some dense book about learning. You will really enjoy it. There's lots of white space on the page, cartoon illustrations, things to really help kids grab a hold of these more esoteric neuroscientific concepts. So thank you, Barb, and we look forward to talking again later this month.
Okay, well, thank you, Julie. Talk to you soon.
That's it for today. I hope you found some ideas you can implement even this week. I'd love to hear from you. Follow me on Instagram at Julie Brave Writer, or you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Brave Writer. In the meantime, live honestly, write bravely. I'm Julie Bogart from Brave Writer.